Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us this evening on New Jersey Revolution Radio. We're on the web at www.njrevolutionradio.com, as well as all the podcast formats. We've got an iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and a few others that I'm probably forgetting right now. If you would like to sponsor New Jersey Revolution Radio, you can go to the web, www.njrevolutionradio.com/make-a-contribution. Or click on the Make a Contribution link from the homepage and give us a few dollars. We are running a GoFundMe right now. And one last announcement before we get into the interview tonight, which is really, really important, is we're going to have our 100th show episode, 100th show celebration in Montclair, New Jersey at the Trend Tea House. It's at 411 Bloomfield Avenue. Come by. We're going to start about 7:30. We're going to do a meet and greet. You're going to meet the New Jersey Revolution Radio community, all of our content providers. I'll be there. My partner Heather will be there. And we will also do a live stream. We've got a couple of panels set up, including a panel for a women's panel, a men's panel too. We're gonna do a What the Fuck Live, What the Fuck is Going On in Trenton with some comrades. And we're going to have some fun and games along the way as well. So it's a celebration, but we are going to hammer on some serious issues. Tonight we have one of those serious issues. I want to thank Patrick Martin for joining me tonight from the World Socialist website. I want to announce him properly. Patrick is a senior political writer from the World Socialist website and a member of the National Socialist Equality Party in the United States. He's been an active participant in the socialist movement for more than 45 years. Thank you for being here tonight, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I want to tell you a little bit about me before we talk about your articles and your work. Is one thing is I can't stand the conspiracy theory left. I don't participate in it. What people's feelings are about vaccines, I think you should vaccinate kids. I believe the government's story about 9/11. And when I hear the word or when I think of conspiracies right away, a whole bunch of red flags go off in my head, because I think those things turn people off to the serious issues that we face in this country. And when I first read the first article that you wrote, Mr. Martin, I was skeptical because I'm skeptical by nature, but it aligns with everything else that I'm seeing right here in New Jersey. What you talk about in these series of articles that you've done is clearly the truth. And it's not a conspiracy theory. And as the father of five boys in this world, all of who will have to go through being of military service age, it makes me very nervous about the culture we're creating. Your first article that I took notice of was a three-part article called The CIA Democrats. What got you to write this? What motivated you to start this series?
Well, I first became aware of the phenomenon. I am the person on the World Socialist website, which provides daily coverage of American and international politics and culture. I am the person who has the main responsibility for following two-party electoral politics in the United States. So I monitor every day the Washington Post, the New York Times, the mainstream media, their blogs, and I follow the Washington political press, Politico, and so on. And in October, I think October of 2017, I ran across a blog entry in the Washington Post that noted that two CIA agents, former CIA agents, had just announced their candidacies for Congress in two widely separated congressional districts. One, Abigail Spanberger in the Richmond-based district in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And another, Alyssa Slotkin, running in a district near me. I live in the Detroit metropolitan area, and her district runs from just at the edge of the Detroit metro area out to Lansing. So I looked at that and I said, oh ho, this was something new. There had been a case of a Republican CIA agent who ran and won a seat in Texas. His name is Will Hurd, a couple of elections ago. But this is the first time I had seen CIA people running as Democratic candidates in the primaries. So I began to take a closer look at the candidates being promoted by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which has a program called Red to Blue, in which they selectively promote candidates in certain districts where they think either the Republican is exceptionally weak and vulnerable, or the Democrat is exceptionally strong and has a good chance to take the district. Yeah, and I noticed that many of the people being promoted initially in the first wave of Red to Blue had military backgrounds. So we discussed it on our editorial board and decided that we would do a systematic examination of all the Democratic candidates in competitive districts. And there were at the time, I think, about 102, and that's up to 115 districts. And I went through FEC reports on their fundraising to determine who was a serious candidate. I went through their websites, and everything that you read in the articles that I wrote in March and the subsequent articles that I wrote this month is the quotes about what they did in the military or the CIA or the National Security Council or the Pentagon is taken from their own words. It's their own account. So there is no conspiracy theory. I agree with you. There's no secret plot to take over the Democratic Party. It's an open takeover of the Democratic Party, to a certain extent. I actually happen to agree with both of your caveats. My children are vaccinated, and I don't believe that the government blew up the World Trade Center. I think it was done by Islamist terrorists. Although I would say that the relationship between the Islamist terrorists and the American government is quite a bit more complicated than is generally allowed.
I would very much agree with that assessment. I think I may rephrase my quote. I don't believe everything the government tells me about that. I should rephrase that. But I think you hit the nail on the head, not to go off on a tangent.
Right.
Go ahead. Please.
Yeah. So in this exposure, we're relying on people who are not hiding their light under the bushel. They are out front, proud. In most cases, I'd say in almost every case, they are using their military, intelligence, national security as their number one credential for public office. And in many of the cases, it's their only credential.
Yeah.
I mean, Alyssa Slotkin went from a college student to the Central Intelligence Agency, to the White House, to the Pentagon, to the Director of National Intelligence, to running for Congress. There's no gaps.
Now, you write that, you know, in historical terms, not only would the candidates want to disguise their connections to the spy apparatus, the CIA itself would insist, particularly for those who work in operations rather than analysis, since exposure, even long after leaving the agency, could be portrayed as compromising sources and methods. So you're telling me that years ago, spies would run for office, but maybe they would retire for a couple of years, do some charity work or something. Whereas today, we're seeing people come straight out of this apparatus and into government?
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I can't remember a precedent for an actual Central Intelligence agent running for public office. Before Will Hurd, I don't know of any. I mean, George Bush, but he was a politician before he became the CIA director. That's a bit different case. Hmm. It used to be, of course, very traditional. The Congress used to be full of World War II veterans.
Right.
That hardly has the same character because that was a mass army. And military service was the common experience of virtually every male who could walk in the United States, who was of age in the 40s. Right. And even into the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you had a draft. But now you have a specialized, highly selective volunteer army. Perhaps 1-2% of the population serves in the military. So to have 10, 20, 30, or 40% of Congress being drawn from that 1% that served voluntarily is something new in American history. That is new.
It is dangerous, and it is showing a level of audacity that an imperialist country gives you, right? There's this arrogance that goes along with being the bad guy on the block and being this imperialist country. I think that's what we are. And so we're seeing, and I'll use the example of Malinowski here in New Jersey, of bragging about their work in Libya. I mean, who the hell in their right mind would brag about destroying a peaceful country and turning it into a terrorist haven with all kinds of misery going on? Well, the kind of people are arrogant people who are endorsing basically white supremacy. And I'm seeing this model in these other campaigns. I think that's what convinced me that you're onto something, because as you stated, they're not running away from it. They're proud of it.
No, I mean, we haven't had anybody write to us to say, my God, you're slandering me. You know, you've said something about me which is hateful. You know, the other side of it is, if you look at their websites and what they say about war and peace in the infrequent occasions when they talk about it, I'm old enough to remember the anti-war GI. Mm-hmm. You know, an anti-war movement which had powerful roots in the military itself, although it wasn't generally from the officers, it was from the ranks. John Kerry got his political start as an anti-war GI in the day, mm-hmm. a position that he's long since repudiated. Yeah. But none of these people is running as, I've been to war, I've seen hell, and I never want it to happen again. They're mm-hmm. all running on the basis of, I went to war, I served, and that proves that you can trust me.
I served. So, you know, I'm a veteran myself. I did 4 years in the Navy when I was much younger and had terrible politics. You're right. And what I think some of that issue is when people come back from military service, especially having undergone the horror that is war, they need to feel accepted. And they're generally not, you don't feel, you feel out of place. You feel like you're coming back to a society that doesn't understand what you're doing. And what veterans groups like the American Legion and the VFW and these right-wing organizations that support imperialism and support white supremacy, they take you in. They're there. They have a bar. You can come drink a beer for a dollar. And they welcome you into this community of veterans, which indoctrinates you into supporting its continued policies. And what we need to see more of is groups like Veterans for Peace and other organizations that welcome veterans in. I think there is a bit of shunning of veterans, if you will. And we saw the same thing in Vietnam. You hear the stories of soldiers being spit on return to war. I can't endorse what they did. It's murder. I mean, it's not something I could feel good about. But understanding that they're victims of war as well, and trying to take them into a community that shows them that there's support in anti-war movements for them as well, may help that problem.
Yeah, well, my experience, and I do go back to the Vietnam War when I was a young person, was that the anti-war people were trying to save the lives of the soldiers. And they were also trying to get the soldiers out of the war before they could become monsters.
You do.
Because mm-hmm. the war, in the worst cases, would turn people into what you had at My Lai and other places, which really happened. Now, we've had you've had Abu Ghraib, you've had all sorts of atrocities, most of them unacknowledged, some of them exposed by WikiLeaks, others, but relatively little interest in the American media today compared to what there was during the Vietnam War. Yeah. In part, perhaps, because the war touched more people then than wars do now. Although, if you look at it cumulatively, since we've been fighting wars for 25 years almost without a break, the number of people who've been damaged in American society by exposure to war is quite large. It's probably 4, 5, 6 million people by now. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's something that was maybe slowly put upon us. It's like boiling the frog, right? These wars are continuing and building and getting bigger. And
the danger is that they've now shifted their perspective. They announced early this year that the national security doctrine of the United States is no longer the war on terror as the center. It's great power conflicts, which means war with nuclear countries like China and Russia is what the military is actively planning and preparing for. that's a quantum leap in terms of destructiveness, potentially, you know, destructiveness on a planetary scale.
It is. It's scary when you talk about it. Now, your initial order article was intriguing enough, but just a couple of weeks ago, you released a second article, and the name of that article is "The CIA Democrats: A Balance Sheet of the Primaries." You went through all the winners in these primaries, and there's quite a few of them. There's a 30, right?
Yes, there are 30 of the. Depending on how you define them, there were somewhere between 55 and 60 people who we identified as having links. You know, the national security was their main background.
Right.
And about a little over half of them won. And the actual success rate was a little higher because there were a lot of what we called spy versus spy contests, where you had two different national security candidates running against each other in the primary. Like in Virginia, Spanberger's opponent, she's the CIA lady, was a Marine fighter pilot. So you got your choice, Dan Ward or Abigail Spanberger. And Spanberger had more money and more internal support and Year of the Woman, and so she won. So some of the national security candidates were defeated, but the district is still represented in the general election by a candidate drawn from that section of the party. And it's the largest group, 30 out of in the 115 competitive districts. These are most of, I think there are four that are Democratic districts that are marginal, that they're barely holding on. And the others are all Republican districts, which they hope to take. And the polling tends to suggest that they're going to get at least half of those, which would be enough. They need 23 seats. And so it looks like the Democrats will retake Congress. But there is a local angle if you want to go to that.
There is, and we want to talk about our, of course, this is New Jersey Revolution Radio, and just so you know, the gimmick, if you will, because it's not very serious, is that we want to form a communist state right here in New Jersey. And then expand outward. So it's like we want to form Cuba here in New Jersey, experiment with communism, and then spread it out to the rest of the United States. I don't know if that was really Trotsky or anybody's plan, but, you know, we're giving it a shot. but back to the serious matter, we do have four candidates here who I only thought we had three, but you told me that all four of these candidates have some type of military background or foreign policy involved in imperialism. And I'd like to go down the list with you and just kind of talk a little bit about each one and what their background is. Do you have a preference with who you'd like to start with?
Do you want to do it numerically, or do you want to do it in order of how you don't like them?
Let's save the one I hate, the one I really, really don't like for last. How's that sound?
All right, that's fine.
All right, so why don't we start with Andy Kim?
All right, Andy Kim is a... he's running in the 3rd district against Tom MacArthur. It's considered a toss-up at this point. He has bucket loads of money, which is pretty amazing, given that he has no political record. And he didn't have serious opposition in the primary. Right. Now, he worked at the Pentagon, and he was a strategic advisor in Afghanistan. He's never been a uniformed combat person. He's a civilian advisor to generals. he advised David Petraeus and John Allen while he was in Kabul, capital of
that job. I'd like to get that job and tell him to stop fucking killing people.
And he then came back to Washington and was on the National Security Council under Obama. And for 2 years, he was Obama's director for Iraq, which is a pretty responsible position when you think about it.
Yeah. I mean,
that's one of the main wars that the United States is engaged in. Now, he left when Obama left the White House. And, you know, he's from that area in New Jersey, and he almost immediately went back and set up shop as a candidate for Congress. The thing that I find the most interesting about his candidacy is that if you look at his website, he has no foreign policy. There's no mention of foreign policy as an issue on his site. He does have a reference to veterans and to making sure that veterans get adequate care. But he doesn't share with the voters of the 3rd Congressional District what his experiences managing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have led him to think about foreign policy, which leads you to believe that he doesn't want them to know. It's a subject better left unsaid. He's hoping to win a seat based upon the backlash against the right-wing Republicans. MacArthur is prominently identified with the attempt to repeal Obamacare. He's a multimillionaire who basically bought his seat. And it's not clear that he'll win, but if he wins, this is Andy Kim, he will be a blank slate as far as foreign policy. He hasn't told the people of New Jersey, I will never send your sons. You know, I've learned my lesson from Iraq. You know, I've learned my lesson from Afghanistan. One can only conclude that the lesson that he learned was what he was doing while he was there, which is to fight these wars as viciously as possible.
I'm interested to hear what the other candidates, but it seems to be this is a guy who's going to die rather than risk his own life.
Yeah, he was, you know, I don't know his area of expertise within the cadre of civilian advisors of the Pentagon. I don't know if he was advising on, you know, managing the civilian government in Afghanistan or the population. I just don't, that's not indicated. But it is a, it's not one of the more attractive features of someone that they were involved in something where thousands of people died on both sides.
And
no conclusions from it.
Him, like all the other candidates we're going to talk about, has not taken any stand for peace. And we just had a rally here in Toms River, which is in Andy Kim's district. He was invited. It was for peace. It was to speak out against war. Something I really think any decent human being should do. Andy Kim chose not to show up, not even to respond to the organizer's invitation. So an idea that they're going to run away from this issue unless we start to show them that the working class in this state cares about war and that it's something that they need to address. Moving on, Josh Wheel. Now, this is the guy that I never really heard about. He's running in the 4th District, I believe.
Yes.
Tell me about Josh, because I think when you brought up his name, it was the first time I even ever heard of
him. Well, he's not a, how to put it? He's not high on the political radar screen because of the nature of the district. Running in the 4th District against Christopher Smith, who's been in Congress for 40 years or 38 years. It's the most upscale district in New Jersey, which is saying something. And it's always been Republican. However, the district is getting funding. The district is not on the red to blue list, but it's on a second list, which the Democratic Congressional Committee calls majority makers, which are sort of the cherry on top. In other words, the red to blue would win them control of Congress. They expect a breakthrough in a handful of these other seats. They don't really know which ones. This could be one if people are just tired of Christopher Smith after 38 years, which is conceivable. I believe he's mostly identified with fanatical opposition to abortion.
Yes.
That's his
I am aware of Chris.
And I would think that even in New Jersey, I mean, especially in New Jersey, this is not a big evangelical state. So I don't know, you know, if that's a particularly strong selling point for him anymore.
It is. It's not evangelical, but the wealthier districts tend to lean Republican, and our southern part of our state is considerably more conservative, it seems at times.
Yeah. Anyway, he is, Josh Wheel was a fairly high-level person. He graduated from the Naval Academy, so he was a Navy officer. He had a 12-year career. He was a strategic advisor to theater commanders. There's no indication that he was an actual commander in combat. He was part of the staff.
Right.
And also, since he was Navy and not Marines, for the most part, he was on ships in the Persian Gulf rather than on site He did spend some time in Afghanistan, which is landlocked. I don't know what a Navy officer does there, but he was advising. There are Navy officers.
There are naval operations that happen on dry land, like CV work.
But his, I don't know beyond what we've reported, that it says his responsibilities, this is his website, his responsibilities spanned from strategically advising the ambassador in Kabul to being executive officer of a naval mine countermeasure ship in the Persian Gulf. Hmm. Interestingly, that duty would have been directed mainly against Iran, because the mine, if you're worried about mine laying, you're not talking about Al-Qaeda, you're not talking about terrorists, you're talking about a state which has mine laying ships, and the Iranians have occasionally threatened and have on some occasions actually done mine laying operations to disrupt oil traffic in the Persian Gulf. But he's now off duty and running for Congress.
Another one. In Montclair, New Jersey, our ex-governor, Chris Christie, said that, I believe he cursed out somebody on the Dell phone one time, said, why don't you go hang out with all the communists in Montclair? And I know all the communists in Montclair were very happy and proud to get a plug. But this next kind of, she comes from Montclair. Unfortunately, I do not believe that she's a communist. I would probably be rooting for her if it was. But Mikey Sherrill is a female helicopter pilot.
Yes.
I think there was, I did read another article, I don't know that you wrote it, that there was special attention given to trying to attract female veterans as part of making sure that the party was staying diverse.
Well, yes, it is noticeable. Yeah, the Democratic Party has nominated, I think, well over 200 women.
Which in general should be a good thing.
Which in general is, you know, perfectly fine. It's, but women is a rather broad category. It includes Rosa Parks and it includes Margaret Thatcher.
True.
You know, and so in this case, you have a large number of the what we've called the CIA Democrats, which only two of them are actual CIA.
Right.
And there's four or five that are military intelligence. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of others that are, they're not rank and file soldiers. They're mostly combat commanders, staff officers, and civilian people who send other people out to do the fighting.
As military backgrounds, I think.
Yes. There are only, of the 30, there's only two that I know of that actually were rank and file soldiers, and only one of those two who is a rank and file soldier in combat.
Wow. Wow. So these are mostly behind the scenes people that really...
Well, no, a lot of the officers fought in combat, but they were leaders of, they were leaders of platoons, leaders of companies.
Right.
The highest ranking is actually Amy McGrath in Kentucky, who's another one of these. She's a another lady pilot. She's a fighter pilot, and she was a lieutenant colonel when she left the service. Mikey Sherrill is a career helicopter pilot.
Yes.
She had 10 years service in Europe and the Middle East. That service ended about the time of the Iraq War, and I have no indication that she was ever in combat or that she was even search and rescue or anything like that. She was mainly a pilot flying admirals around. So she was a personnel transport pilot. She then retired from the military after that. She did 10 years and then she went to law school and became a federal prosecutor. And she's been a federal prosecutor in Northwest New Jersey, in the area where you're Patterson and to the west, for a number of years, had four kids, and now is running for Congress. So there's a group of these 30 who didn't go directly take off the uniform today, start collecting campaign contributions tomorrow. Some of them built lower level political careers or went through more conventional political training, like being a prosecutor, before they ran for Congress. And she's one of those. She has been all but gifted the seat because the incumbent Republican retired The Democratic field was largely cleared. She had $2 million before anybody else had a dime. So somebody really wanted her in Congress. And she now has a fundraising lead of about 10 to 1 over the Republican, whose name is Jay Weber.
Wow.
Now we get to your favorite.
Yeah, so I got to do an intro on this jacket.
You do.
So I, as most people know, I work with the Greens and the Dianne Moxley campaign. She's running in CD7. And, you know, leading up to this in the primaries, there was Peter Jacob. There was, you know, who ran the last time around. And when Peter Jacob ran the last time around, he did okay. He ran a pretty decent campaign, got a nice turnout for what was thought to be a solid Republican seat. But instead of supporting Peter and getting behind Peter and pumping him up for that next round because he was ready to go again, they did everything they could to make sure anybody remotely to the left of Ronald Reagan didn't get that nomination. They ran a buttload of other candidates to muddy up the field. They pumped a bunch of money into a dude that seemingly just parachuted in from out of nowhere. I don't know whether he literally parachuted out of a C-130 over New Jersey and came here one day, or whether he drove in by car, but nobody heard of the dude. He hasn't spent a minute in New Jersey for years other than, I guess, he has a house somewhere. But he didn't live in the district. He still doesn't live in the district. And all these liberals lined up behind Tom Malinowski so that he could try to take on Leonard Lance in NJ7. It's the most pathetic attempt at carpetbagging I've ever seen in my whole life. And then, as I get to know Tom, I find out he's got the background of the State Department. And that's where you take over and tell us about Tom Malinowski, my buddy.
Well, Tom Malinowski has a resume which is very misleading, because he's presented as a great advocate of human rights because he headed the Washington Office of Human Rights Watch for 13 years.
Yes.
However, both before and after that period of time, he was working very closely with the American State Department, an association which, in my opinion, didn't change when he became the American representative, when he became the head of the American Office of Human Rights Watch. Because Human Rights Watch is fairly notorious for having antennae for the atrocities committed by governments that the United States government doesn't like, and for ignoring atrocities committed by governments that the United States government is allied with. It's very selective in its outrage over human rights violations. Malinowski got his political start as an aide to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who's a quintessential Cold War liberal. He then went on to serve in the State Department under Bill Clinton, where he was a speechwriter. So he wrote speeches for Warren Christopher, the lawyer who was Clinton's first Secretary of State, and then for Madeleine Albright.
Yes, I believe Madeleine Albright will be coming to New Jersey for a fundraiser
to help him. Yes, because he wrote speeches for her. So that means that when they were bombing Kosovo and Serbia, when they were bombing Iraq in 1998 and so on, when they were firing missiles into Sudan over nerve gas factories that turned out to be making animal vaccines, He was writing the speeches to justify that. So then when the Democrats lost the White House, he went to Human Rights Watch and he stayed there. And through the first term, he did not join under Clinton for whatever reason. I think he and Clinton didn't get along. But John Kerry brought him into the State Department as Assistant Secretary in charge of human rights. So he could do at the State Department what he'd been doing through the NGO route, which was politically crucify governments that the United States government is opposed to for crimes that they committed, and giving a pass to governments like the Saudi Arabian government, which are among the worst human rights violators on the planet, but which the U.S. government prefers to say nothing about because of their security interests and their oil interests in that region.
Yeah, very much.
So now he's out of work, and he came back to New Jersey, or came to New Jersey for the first time, What's noticeable is that there are six or seven people with that background. People who were Clinton aides, Kerry aides, Albright aides. He's got the longest track record, along with a woman named Nancy Soderbergh, who was on the National Security Council for Clinton, and then was she was the deputy UN ambassador for Clinton. Mm-hmm. Went into a group called the International Crisis Group, which is another one of these human rights, pro-US human rights groups. And now she's got the congressional nomination in Florida in the 6th Congressional District. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of these people, and I've included them all under the category CIA Democrats because the label is more punchy.
That's true. I thank you for that input. And what I'll do is, because we want to talk a little bit about what you're going through over at the World Socialist website in defending your right to be heard, I want to get to that. But I just want to thank you again for coming on here tonight. Let people know that you really think you need to go check out the CIA Democrats and the most recent article. And you know what? Judge for yourselves. Because I am, like I stated earlier, I'm skeptical. I see this kind of stuff. I think maybe people are flying off the handle. But if you take a look at what our comrade here has written about and start looking at these people's Twitter feeds, start looking at their Facebook pages, start looking at these things and understand that you've got a culture. It may not be a conspiracy. They may not have all gotten in a room and say, hey, we're going to take over the Congress through a military coup. Maybe that didn't happen. But the culture of imperialism, the culture of white supremacy, the culture of this horrible, violent foreign policy that the United States of America has been engaged in for my children's lifetimes and too much of mine.
If I could add a contemporary
aspect, please.
Of this?
Sure, yeah.
The Democratic Party has been aligned for the last 18 months with a campaign being waged largely by the military intelligence apparatus against Trump.
Yes.
Trying to bring Trump down, not because he's a racist or an anti-immigrant demagogue or a fascist or an aide to Wall Street, but because he's a Russian, which is absurd. You know, he's not a stooge of Russia. He's a stooge of Wall Street and a stooge of the military itself. Okay. But because they're politically aligned with the military intelligence apparatus, they're opening their doors to recruit. Why do these people? Because the question is not just why does the Democratic Party want them? Why do they want the Democratic Party? Why has the Democratic Party become their preferred vehicle? Well, partly it's pragmatic. They know the Democratic Party is going to win the election. All right, so there's no point in joining the Republican Party and looking for open seats because there aren't going to be any. Mm-hmm. But they're joining the Democratic Party because they have a political alignment on this question, particularly.
Yeah. Contrary to what most liberals believe.
Contrary to what most liberals believe. And I'm old enough to remember when there was genuine outrage by liberals. Go look up Frank Church and his committee over the CIA playing a role in domestic life, spying on anti-war demonstrators, spying on Daniel Ellsberg, and so on. Yeah. Now, it's open house.
It's scary to think of. I do want to thank you. I think it's really brave what you're doing, exposing this stuff. It's good to know that New Jersey Revolution Radio can help expose it. But being able to get our message out to people could become increasingly more difficult. And you wanted to make sure that we mentioned some things that you're going through at your website with, I guess, being listed on Google. Explain what's going on, please.
Well, it's another one of these non-conspiracy conspiracy theories. Mm. That is a conspiracy theory where we're not asking you to believe anything wild and crazy. We're just asking you to look at mathematical, numerical algorithms. We noticed in April of 2017 that our referrals, because we follow our traffic.
Right, sure.
Our referrals through Google began to drop very sharply. And within about 5 weeks, Google accounted at that time for about half of our traffic. Our Google traffic had dropped by 75%.
Wow.
And not only that, but if you Googled socialism in March of 2017, World Socialist website came up pretty high up in the search, which kind of makes sense. If you Googled socialism in May of 2017, World Socialist website didn't come up in the first 100 search terms. If you Googled Leon Trotsky, who is the founder of our party, and which we're almost exclusively among different tendencies on the left, we are identified with Trotsky. If you searched for Leon Trotsky in March, you got us, number one or number two. If you search for Leon Trotsky in May, you get Russians who hate Trotsky. Wow. You know, you get anti-communists. You don't get the people who actually publish Trotsky's writings and think that his writings are still relevant. And I could give you, which I won't, we've published them, 150 of the top 150 search terms that referred Google searchers to us. Zero now refer Google to us in the first 200 searches.
Wow.
So we then began to investigate, and we found that this actually originated in Germany. The head of one of the Google executives went to Germany, and there was a big complaint because our German group was raising holy hell about what has now become the AfD. The alternative for alternative for Deutschland, which is the neo-Nazi. And we were warning early on that these people were getting a support from the government and from the political establishment, and they were dangerous. And that there were certain academics who were legitimizing them. Hmm. And because of that, they were complaints. We had a libel suit, which we won. And somebody called this Google executive in the government and said, look, these people are making trouble. We want you to downgrade them. So in the German search, they started to downgrade us. And then it was carried over into the English search. We subsequently found that in April, a memo was sent out by Google to its executives, advising them that there had been a significant, that they had decided to change the search algorithm because of complaints related to fake news in the 2016 elections.
Yeah.
And this relates to something that was fostered by the Washington Post, claiming that searches were being disproportionately sent to anti-Clinton sites that were peddling theories like Pizzagate and all this nonsense.
Right. Yeah. Okay. The Alex Joneses.
So in the guise of a crackdown on the far right, they had changed their algorithm. We then started checking other left sites, and we found that Truthdig and Truthout and Axios and I don't have the list in front of me, but a whole bunch of left sites, all of them had lost search engine referrals in the range of 50 to 75%. They were suffering severe losses in their traffic. And these are significant sites. These are people, 20,000, 50,000 in a month. You know, so a lot of people are reading them, and suddenly they're not referred. Now, they're not censoring in the literal sense. We're still on the internet. You can still, if you type in our URL, you'll get to us. But the most we've had to engage in a many, many time-consuming methods, particularly using social media, to try to promote the site, to get around the fact that you no longer get us when you do a search, an ordinary Google search for words where you'd think social inequality. You think that the Socialist Equality Party might come up under a search for social inequality. We used to. We don't any longer.
That's crazy.
So we sent an open letter to Google, which they didn't answer. There was, amazingly, a New York Times article on the subject with a photograph of our chairman, David North, a fairly sympathetic article by their tech writer, published in about a year ago, noting that there were charges, it wasn't just right-wing groups that were upset with Google, left-wing groups were upset with Google. But that's sort of been dropped. It hasn't been followed up since then. And there's been no change. If anything, it's expanded because Facebook has now started doing the same thing. Although we're able to do social media. But for instance, we ran a candidate who was on the ballot in California for governor of California, Socialist mm-hmm. Equality Party candidate. We petitioned, cool. We got on the ballot. Cool. He set up a Facebook page. They started blocking it. Wow. Facebook started blocking it because they claimed that the material was inflammatory, violated their rules. So what's developing, and I'm sure you're out there, you're on the edge, so you're going to be encountering it as well.
You've been encountering some of this as well on a smaller scale, but yes.
Yes. Look, if the internet remains under the control of 5, 6, 7, 8 giant international corporations, it cannot sustain indefinitely what has been its most attractive feature, which is that anybody can get on it and say anything they want and let the chips fall where they may. You know, the long-term future of that model is in danger. And that is a threat to democratic rights and to a free press. Because if you say everything has to go through the gatekeepers, like the New York, they're gonna surface authoritative content. That's the Orwellian language. We are surfacing authoritative content. That means the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal to them. By the way, we found out that Weekly Standard is considered authoritative comment, authoritative news source. Do you know what that is?
No.
Bill Kristol's neocon journal.
God.
Owned by Rupert Murdoch, or it was owned. I don't know if Murdoch still owns it.
Yeah.
But it's an opinion. It's like saying that we will only surface the Nation.
Right. That's crazy.
You know, which of course they don't. You know, but it's the right-wing equivalent of the Nation. That's being treated as authoritative content, and they actually took down, I think this was Truth Dig, they took down an article they downgraded an article from Truth Dig because the Weekly Standard complained about it.
Wow, that's crazy. And I think what you're seeing is corporations having supplanted the states as the power, the global power. And now trying to shape society as they see fit. Whereas it used to be the state, I guess, that would try to shape society. You're now seeing corporations shape society on a global scale. And generally the way corporations do things is not something we should trust to shape our society.
And I would suggest, however, that the Pentagon and the CIA are still more powerful than Google, Facebook, and Amazon, because to some extent they created them.
Yeah. Well, isn't that why they want to control government then? So they can control those entities that support them as well. I think it is.
Well, there's the corporate what we used to be called the military industrial complex in the days of Dwight Eisenhower, the original truth teller. Yeah. Now you have a military intelligence high tech complex in which Silicon Valley is increasingly being integrated into that. And the most adamant about doing that, about subordinating and integrating all those together, are Democrats like Mark Warner, Dianne Feinstein, Adam Schiff. They're using the Russia investigation as a way of beating down the traditional separation between the press, the media, and the government. And is suggesting now that the government should basically control and regulate what appears on the internet from the standpoint of national security.
I think guys like us could go on and on with all the problems that we have here. We could throw in white supremacy and the prison pipeline as well, but we don't have time for all that tonight. Patrick, I was very excited leading up to this interview. I think your work is tremendous. It educated me. It brought me along in my political development. So I want to thank you for that. I want to thank everybody out there listening on our podcast or viewing this on our live stream. Please share this with your comrades. I think this is an extraordinarily important topic that we get educated about how our political system works. This is a significant part of it. So continue to do your research and please support the World Socialist website. Their website, if it's not on Google, it's pretty easy to remember. It's WSWS.org. I put it in the comments a little while ago. So click on it, check them out, support them, and please give us a few dollars here at New Jersey Revolution Radio. We've got a GoFundMe. It's in the comments. It's all over the website. You can find it. Anything you can give. Leading up to our 100th episode, we want to throw a nice party for everybody, and we want to continue to produce podcasts like this that educate and agitate right here in the great state of New Jersey. Patrick, thanks again for joining me. I'll see you soon. All right, brother?
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.